And welcome back to South Florida Arts Beat here on 91.3 WLRN, South Florida's NPR news station, and 91.5 WKWM, NPR for the Florida Keys. Hello, Ed Bell with you. Coming up on the program today, our classical arts contributor Charles Greenfield previews the Cypress String Quartet's performance for Sunday Afternoons of Music in Coral Gables this weekend. Chef Norman Van Aken delivers a word on food, and our Broward County Arts Calendar features Jody Horn-Leschinski, Community Development Director of the Broward Cultural Division. Dedicated to the investigation and preservation of significant archaeological and historical sites throughout Florida and the Caribbean, the Archaeological and Historical Conservancy, Incorporated, has put us all in touch with our region's history and prehistory. Most South Floridians don't know that Native Americans have lived in South Florida for 12,000 years or more. Our guest today, together with his colleagues, have uncovered evidence of prehistoric and historic habitation virtually right under our feet. Beginning in 1985 with their excavations at the Cutler Fossil Site south of the Deering Estate in Miami-Dade County, the Conservancy has documented over 1,000 sites throughout Florida and the Caribbean. The organization's founder and executive director, Bob Carr, has recently published his latest book, Digging Miami, available from the University Press of Florida, that details this exciting prehistory and historic sites in Miami-Dade and Broward counties. And we want to welcome back to the show Mr. Bob Carr. Hello, Bob.
Hey, hello.
Good to have you join us today, sir. And I must say, what a wonderful book Digging Miami is. And we want to talk about great sites that you cover in that wonderful book. And let's start with give me a brief list of the archaeologists, amateur and professionals, who have been revealing our region's history throughout the years, if you would.
Surprisingly, there have been people, archaeologists, visiting South Florida from the late 1860s. Mm. Those were brief visits. Mosquitoes and realities kept anybody from doing any very extensive investigations. But in the mid 20th century, Dr. John Goggin from the University of Florida did the first intensive surveys and investigations in South Florida, and followed by an avocational archaeologist, Dan Laxon, who just did a terrific job cataloging sites that were on the verge of destruction from development, and that led to several archaeological societies being active in the area as well.
Mm-hmm. There were extensive Tequesta Indian sites on both the north and south sides of the Miami River, and you discovered the famous Miami Circle site on the south side of the river. That's Miami-Dade's oldest prehistoric site, is it not?
Well, it's not the oldest site, but it's the first site to actually document and preserve an architectural feature related to the Tequesta, a complete circular foundation 38 feet in diameter.
Tell us how that discovery took place for you.
Well, what was interesting about the discovery was that it was a fulfillment in part of the City of Miami's Historic Preservation Ordinance, and that is that any developer is required to have an archaeological assessment in areas of high potential for sites along the river and along Biscayne Bay. But surprisingly, in that case, when I was driving over the Brickell Bridge, I saw the demolition of the Brickell Apartments. I knew there was no archaeologists involved. So we made sure there was an archaeologist there, and it was a short while after, in fact, in our first or second shovel hole, that we actually came down on the Miami Circle.
Mm. Now, you found, literally thousands of artifacts from that site? Can you mention a few that are very important?
Well, the significant artifacts were things like galena and quartz and basalt, things that are not native to South Florida or Florida at all. These were all indicative of trade items that had come from as far away as Missouri, the Appalachian Mountains. So we knew that we had found something significant when we began to find this variety of non-local exotic materials, that this had to have been perhaps a ceremonial structure, perhaps that of a chief. But that was one of the most important discoveries now made in Tequesta archaeology.
There was all sorts of faunal artifacts as well, a shark and a turtle shell, among others, a dolphin jaw, do I remember correctly?
That's correct. We actually found within the circle proper where animals had been interred, a shark that was laid out east to west, about 6 foot, 7 foot lemon shark. There was a sea turtle also laid out east to west, and the skull of a bottlenose dolphin, all within 10 feet of one another, all within the same feature.
What do you derive from all of the evidence? What are your final thoughts on what this site was? Ceremonial?
The Miami Circle was definitely a high-status, important ceremonial location. Perhaps the chief, the cacique, lived there. Perhaps it was a council house. We don't really know with certainty. But certainly both sides of the Miami River were the focal point of Tequesta civilization in terms of a major habitation area for these people, these indigenous people that were there from at least 700 B.C. based on radiocarbon dates.
Now, you also found some human bones at the site, did you not?
Well, at the Miami Circle, we found very few human bones, only a very few couple of elements of long bone fragments and some teeth. It was definitely not a burial site, but we found nearby, we did find some graves, and we found an extensive cemetery on the north side of the river.
Mm-hmm. Well, let's talk about the north side. When you were doing some work at the Henry Flagler's Royal Palm Hotel, what a magnificent structure that was. I guess the first big hotel in Miami. You found some very interesting things, as well as two or three other circle areas, did you not?
That's correct. We've been working on the north side of the Miami River since 2005, and so far we've found not only the foundations of portions of the Royal Palm Hotel dating back to 1896, but we've actually found one of the rooms that had held the keys. We actually found over 100 of the room keys that had collapsed onto the floor after the demolition of the hotel. We found foundations with stairwells, piers from the veranda, all these things being faithfully documented, some of them already documented and some still ongoing. In addition to the hotel, we found the early history of the pioneers on the north side of the river in terms of their artifacts, some scattered artifacts from Fort Dallas in a couple of places, and most importantly, in many ways, the Tequesta themselves in terms of their remains. Now, they had a important burial mound structure on the north side of the river, but unfortunately it was demolished by the Royal Palm Hotel construction. That mound was in the way of the view of the soon-to-becoming visitors, so that unfortunately that mound was hauled away. But we've actually found places where the mound was taken to, and there again removing the human remains, most of which have already been reinterred.
Before we wrap up our first segment with Bob Carr, tell us about a little bit more about the Royal Palm Circle. The same sort of structure that you found on the south side of the river is also to be found on the north side, is it not?
We have so far now found two structures on the north side. These are somewhat more modest in construction than the Miami Circle. One is 36 feet in diameter, another one is 38 feet. They're characterized by post holes cut right into the bedrock, and I suspect that these may be habitations in terms of the houses that were built along the shoreline for the Tequesta.
Did you find approximately the same kind of artifact material on the north side as you found at the Miami Circle on the south side of the river?
No, in fact, that's a good question, because missing on the north side was that extensive exotic material associated with these two structures, reinforcing the fact that the Miami Circle was the very special one, the very high-status structure. In fact, we're finding much more of what might be considered mundane, the broken pieces of Tequesta pottery, faunal bone, shell refuse, the kind of things that were associated with normal everyday life.
Bob Carr on South Florida Arts Beat, our guest today, the former Miami-Dade County archaeologist and founder and executive director of the Archaeological and Historical Conservancy Incorporated, located in Davie. You can go to their website at flarchaeology.org. You can go to his publisher, and that is UPF, as in University Press of Florida.com, or you can call Conservancy directly at 954-792-9776. We'll be back with more with Mr. Bob Carr. Stay with us.
Remember this, our favorite.
And we have about 20 minutes past the hour here on South Florida Arts Beat. Ed Bell with you, and our guest, Mr. Bob Carr, former Miami-Dade County archaeologist, the first, I believe, and founder and executive director of the Archaeological and Historical Conservancy Incorporated. For more info about that marvelous organization, go to flarchaeology.org, or you can go to his publisher, upf.com, and his latest book telling us about our roots is called Digging Miami, from University Press of Florida. Bob is in Green Turtle Cay in Abaco in the Bahamas, taking part in the Island Roots Heritage Festival, and we trust it's gorgeous there, Bob?
Well, it is now. There's been some pretty heavy rains like in Florida, but it's a beautiful day today.
Well, the habitation sites here in Southeast Florida are so numerous, in fact, all throughout the state, of course, but unfortunately we don't have enough time to talk about all of them, but let's just mention a few. Tell us about the Arch Creek area in North Miami and that marvelous natural bridge.
One of the principal prehistoric sites and historic sites in Miami is at Arch Creek, fortunately now part of a wonderful park experience. Unfortunately, the eve of the acquisition of that land, saving it from a car dealership, becoming a public park, the natural arch collapsed. It was eventually rebuilt. But the site itself is still magical. It still has wonderful archaeological and historical aspects and natural aspects. So it's just a great place to visit.
In the interest of full disclosure, I was a very happy volunteer for the Archaeological Society of South Florida in the mid-'80s, digging on the old Cutler fossil site, quite an intriguing site. What was found there, Bob?
The Cutler fossil site was a very important site because there was a record of human habitation in Southeast Florida going back 11,000 years, and something that old had never been found in extreme southern Florida before. But just as importantly as the human record was the fact that we had an environmental record of the great catastrophic changes associated with the end of the Ice Age. We found over 120 species of animals represented, including a mastodon, mammoth, saber-toothed cat, three species of bear, paleo llama. I mean, I can go on in the list. We even found California condor, which had never been found in southern Florida. So what an incredible record of what Florida had been like and all the changes that had occurred as a result of an extreme catastrophic weather event.
Do I remember correctly that also there were baby skull pieces that were found that were burned?
There was one juvenile buried under the ledge that appeared to be less than 2 years of age, and it appeared to have been burnt as part of some kind of ritual, as part of the interment.
Oh, really? You can derive that much as opposed to, say, a lightning strike that might have encompassed the area?
Just looking at the bone right there, it was easy to determine. It was a uniform treatment of the bones and was deliberately placed in this one particular place. That was one of five individuals that we were able to identify that had been buried in this site. Most of the bones were disarticulated. They were broken and fragmentary. One of the bones actually had a carnivore tooth from some large carnivore that had perforated the long bone and broken it into two parts. We even found some human bones that had been burnt, and we didn't know what to make of those, almost as if they had been cooked like the other bones that we found that were burnt nearby.
Well, let's go from those early prehistoric sites to Miami's pioneers. They tell quite interesting stories when you have excavated their houses and whatnot. Let's start with the Brickells, and they were located on the south side of the Miami River.
That's correct. William and Mary Brickell arrived from Ohio, I believe in 1870 or 1871, and built this just wonderful house on the south side of the river, and eventually the location became known as Brickell Point. They also had a trading post with the Seminoles. And through the years, I've been able to do extensive excavations in that area as development has gone and changed the landscape and changed the buildings. It seems like even new buildings, like the Holiday Inn, eventually became obsolete. That was demolished, and the new buildings have been put on top of that. But through all of that, we've been able to record a tremendous amount of the history of the Brickell family, the various artifacts that were associated directly with the family, but also a large number of seminal artifacts used in terms of trade, many hundreds of glass beads, for example, that were in the basement of the Brickell house.
Mm-hmm. Let's move on to the pioneer homesteads of Coconut Grove, one of the very earliest areas settled down here.
That's right. Coconut Grove was a prime location for these early settlers, some of the intellectual giants of their time in terms of their familiarity with yachting and with boats, like the Monroes came down there. There were the Peacocks building a very nice hotel, and that development, actually, that settlement, brought in a lot of the first Bohemian blacks that came into the area, getting jobs and working in that area, and created the first black Bohemian settlement in Coconut Grove.
The pictures, I believe, Kirkman Rowe took, there's Arvemore Parks has published a number of books of those amazing pictures. And what an advanced community that must have been.
Well, Ralph Monroe was quite a scholar.
Ralph, yes.
Right, and Kirk Monroe, coincidentally not related, was the author who wrote so many fictional accounts of mm-hmm. South Florida. But between those two, the literary giant and the genius of this photography, we had this extraordinary record of with the wilderness of South Florida and those early settlements.
Now, the Archaeological and Historical Conservancy, of course, conducts archaeological and historical assessments, surveys, investigations, excavations. But I'm sorry. I think we've lost our guest. We will try to get him back on the line. But we are coming to the end of our segment, unfortunately, with Mr. Bob Carr, former Miami-Dade County archaeologist and founder and executive director of the Archaeological and Historical Conservancy, Incorporated, located at 4800 Southwest 64th Avenue, Suite 107 in Davie. You can call them directly, 954-792-9776. Go to their website for more information. I was about ready to mention that they have a traveling exhibition called We Were Here, and that is wrapping up May the 4th at the Okeechobee County Historical Society and their county library. It starts May 9th and runs through June 14th at the Osceola County Historical Society in Kissimmee. And for more info about Digging Miami, you can go to the University Press of Florida website at upf.com. And Bob Carr's latest book, Digging Miami, and we thank him very much. Stay with us here on South Florida Arts Beat. It's South Florida Arts Beat here on 91.3 WLRN and 91.5 WKWM. Hello, Ed Bell with you. Later on the program, Chef Norman Van Aken returns with A Word on Food, and our Broward Arts Calendar features Jody Horn-Leschinski, Community Development Director of the Broward Cultural Division. Sunday Afternoons of Music will conclude their 32nd season with a performance by a renowned string quartet from San Francisco. Here's our classical arts contributor, Charles Greenfield, to tell us more.
Some music observers consider the classical string quartet the ideal ensemble, four string instruments in search of a common voice. Earlier this season on South Florida's cultural scene, Julian Krieger's Friends of Chamber Music brought the marvelous Tokyo String Quartet in January and the very adept Ennis String Quartet in March. Not to miss a step, Doreen Marks and her very popular Sunday Afternoons of Music presents the San Francisco-based Cypress String Quartet on May 5th at UM's Gussman Hall at 4 p.m. The Cypress String Quartet consists of Cecily Ward, violin, Tom Stone, violin, Ethan Filner, viola, and Jennifer Kletzel, cello. Critics have called their music making artistry of uncommon insight and cohesion, and the Washington Post refers to it as beautifully proportioned and powerful. The ensemble has shown a strength of character from its inception in 1996 with J.S. Bach's chorales to their latest CDs on Beethoven's late string quartets from last year and their most recent from this spring, Dvorak's Cypresses for String Quartet, which happens to be the origin of their group name as well. An innovative aspect to their concert calendar is their call-and-response program, in which the Cypress Quartet commissions and premieres new string quartets from both emerging and celebrated composers. They've commissioned and premiered over 30 pieces. A recent composer to add her work to the mix is Jennifer Higdon, a young Tennessee composer whose work is based on five poems by the great American poet W.S. Merwin. The members of the Cypress Quartet play exceptional instruments, including violins by Antonio Stradivarius, 1681, and Carlos Berganzi, 1733, a viola by Vittorio Bellarosa, 1947, and a cello by Hieronymus Amati II, 1701. Recently, I spoke to the Cypress String Quartet's spokesperson, their cellist, Jennifer Kletzel, about the ensemble, their style and content, performance schedule, and goals for the future. Jennifer Kletzel, welcome to South Florida Arts Beat.
Thank you. I'm glad to be here.
How did you assemble the four components of the Cypress String Quartet? You've been a unit since 1996. You represent four different string instruments. There must be a certain sound that results from years of playing together. Can you describe that subtlety?
Well, actually, I'm trying to recover from the whole components. I've never been called a component before, and I love it. we are a unit, yes. Well, actually, one of the interesting things about our quartet in specific is that we hail from all across the U.S., and I think that really speaks to how music, you know, can bring people together. So we have an East Coaster. I grew up in Maryland. We have a Midwesterner. Tom grew up in Chicago. He's our second violinist. Our first violinist is from Utah, and our violist grew up in the San Francisco Bay Area. So, but of course, music brought us together, and specifically a desire to play this amazing music and to just steep ourselves in it, especially the great old masters. And when we came together and started, you know, rehearsing together 5 or 6 hours a day in the early days, we found a lot of other things that we loved that we had in common in terms of that we really wanted to commission music and make sure this art form stayed current, and that so not only to stay in Beethoven and Dvorak and all the great, you know, Schubert great masters, but to also make sure that there was great new music being written as well. And then, you know, just finding out the blend of sound and how we wanted to create a new, as you called it, a unit. To make a new voice, because a string quartet is not really four people anymore. It's a new instrument, just with four.
Exactly, exactly. We'll maybe explore that idea of what mm-hmm. the sound is in a little while. I read that you and the other players were influenced by the Amadeus and Juilliard quartets, and I understand this idea of apprenticeship, but what other musical ideas do you seek from master musicians in gaining a group or even self-identity?
Well, I would say, actually, although we do claim the Amadeus and Juilliard as influences, we're a real kind of maverick, independent thinker kind of group. I mean, we came together outside of, you know, of the safety net of a school. We had all finished our studies and decided to come together and figure this out on our own. I'll never forget our first year together, we won a competition in the Midwest, and the head of the competition kept saying, "Where did you learn to play Brahms like that?" And we said, "Well, nobody taught us do this. We came together. We are, in fact, each other's teachers, right? In fact, I remember the first couple years I was in the group, all I thought was, I've learned more working with these three other people in a room together for all these hours a day, you know, for this amount of time than I ever did from any single teacher that I worked with. However, working with great musicians who've been around, who played, you know, the Amadeus Quartet played together for, was it 40 years? Or something, and we went to two seminars in the summer, so those were just 2 weeks long, in London. The first couple years we were together, we went and worked with them, and they appealed to us. We had listened to a lot of their recordings and really loved their style and their sound, the way they approached, especially Schubert and Haydn, and so we wanted to learn from them, and actually Britten as well. The Britten quartets had been written for them, so we went and worked on those with them. And, you know, there is, I mean, music has always had a type of apprenticeship, but we also all felt like we had had a lot of teaching and wanted to actually get out there and try it out for ourselves.
Well, why don't we talk for a second about this call and response program that you've initiated over the years, because that's certainly very different. Would you quickly define this process?
Sure. Okay. And this is we've done this project for 14 years now. And basically, call and response, we took the name from the jazz and gospel tradition of, somebody places a call and somebody else responds back to that. And in this case, what we were looking for is, the idea behind call and response is inspiration. What inspires composers to write music? So often it's Mozart will look at a quartet by Haydn and be so amazed by it, you can see the direct influence of two specific pieces. So that we would program those together and then commission a living composer to write a response to that older dialogue. So it's partly a commissioning project. It's partly a project exploring inspiration. And, for example, this year we did, the inspiration was all about poetry, music that was influenced specifically by poetry. And so we had music by Dvorak, music by Schubert, and then Jennifer Higdon, the great Philadelphia-based composer, who wrote a piece for us on all three where, you could really draw these ideas from. Here are the poems, and here's what resulted from it. And even if these poems don't really exist anymore, we're not thinking about them, they influenced this composer, and then they wrote in this way. And it's such a fun way to look at how people work and how composers write music. We also do a lot of outreach into the community, not just in schools, but all throughout the community to talk about these ideas. And then the culmination is a concert where we present that program.
Well, I think what we need to talk about now is Doreen Marks' Sunday Afternoons of Music at UM's
yes.
Gussman Hall, Sunday, May 5th at 4 p.m. You're doing Dvorak, and you're doing, I believe, Mozart and Beethoven. Why don't we start with the Dvorak, because your group is named after, basically, Dvorak's cypresses.
That's correct. It's very hard to name a group when you start out because it seems like all the great names are taken. So we debated this for hotly for a number of months. But we kept coming back to the music. The music is what we're all about. And there are a set of love songs for string quartet by Antonín Dvořák called The Cypresses. And they're so beautiful. And the way that Dvořák uses a string quartet, now, first of all, his melodies are sublime. They just are, He wrote a lot of vocal music, but that comes across in his music. But every part is so individual and, complicated, but it all adds up to this wonderful texture. And so we decided that, why not be named after these beautiful pieces that not many people knew about? And so we've been playing them a lot over the years as well. Now, it helps that the cypress tree is indigenous to the California coastline, which is we're based in San Francisco. And so,
right.
So that fits with Florida, too, though.
Well,
right?
you could be called the Palm String Quartet, but then you'd have to move. But you're also doing Mozart's String Quartet in C, known as the Dissonance, and I think Beethoven's String Quartet in F.
That's right.
Two very different works, but really maybe not that different.
No, Beethoven, Mozart was his idol. And in fact, we're performing the first down there in Miami, but the third is influenced very directly by the Mozart. It's the same key. There are so many similarities. We actually paired those on a call and response program one year. It's always interesting to me to look at who the great composers look to as their ideals, and Beethoven really was so impressed by Mozart and what he could do and wanted to come study with him, but Mozart passed away before Beethoven could get there in time. So I think that the pairing of their music, they're very different. Their styles are very different, but the music really goes together very well. And you can see the development of, Mozart's is a little more, smooth, I guess you'd say, a little less disruptive, and Beethoven always plays with your expectations. But that Mozart quartet that we're performing, the Dissonance, is, I think, Mozart's greatest string quartet.
I really think that you have a wonderful program, and I think that our audience here in South Florida will certainly be taken by it. And I want to thank you so much for joining us on South Florida Arts Beat.
We're really excited. Thank you.
As the 2012-13 South Florida cultural season comes to an end, Doreen Marks' Sunday Afternoons of Music series brings the Cypress String Quartet to UM's Gussman Hall on May 5th at 4 p.m. Considered one of the best string quartets of the younger generation on the shoulders of such great groups as Tokyo, Juilliard, and Amadeus, the four San Francisco-based musicians will spoil listeners with a heavy dose of Dvorak mixed with Mozart and Beethoven. Virtuosity and sensitivity will certainly create the musical atmosphere this Sunday at UM's Gussman Hall. For ticket information, call 305-271-7150 or go to the website at sundaymusicals.org. For South Florida Arts Beat, I'm Charles Greenfield.
Charles Greenfield is a classical music contributor for the Sun Sentinel and has written for the Miami Herald. You can email him at cdgpm@bellsouth.net. Please stay with us. South Florida Arts Beat continues in just a moment. Welcome back to South Florida Arts Beat. Ed Bell with you. It's quite an honor for us to include the renowned chef Norman Van Aken on the show. Here's his segment, A Word on Food.
I don't want French fried potatoes, red ripe tomatoes. I'm never satisfied. I want the frim-fram sauce with the offs and fade, with shafafa on the side. Shoot.
Hi, I'm Norman Van Aken, and welcome to A Word on Food. Today's word on food, chicken curry. I was sitting on the veranda of a hotel overlooking Waikiki Beach waiting for a lunch menu. The mighty Pacific Ocean purred like a Lamborghini in the distance. I'd spent hours walking in Chinatown from early morning looking for beautiful and unique dishes I love to use for the thematic tasting menus at our restaurant. But I had had little luck, and a keen hunger was rising up in me. An Asian gentleman dining solo near me was served a platter of chicken curry I'd seen on the menu. His waitress lifted strips of shredded chicken from a porcelain serving bowl and draped them gracefully over a mound of white rice. A curry, orange-rich cream was spooned over this. The intoxicating aromas wafted over in my direction. I saw the older man smile, as if a young man once again. I quickly ordered the same dish. When mine arrived, I was also pleased to see that it included bell peppers, fennel, celery, and carrots in the cream, as well as an interesting spicy chutney and a mound of sweet toasted coconut. All of this was mixed together by me as I ate. I wondered, why had I not eaten chicken curry in so long? I'd like to offer some cooking advice in the midst of lunch, if you don't mind. Good. The thing with curry is that it is almost without exception so much better if you cook out the raw spice, and it is easy, really. You'd end up with a bitter thing if you stirred off-the-shelf curry powder into cold mayonnaise. Ugh! No wonder some folks do not like curry. So my way is to insert a middle step. I take some sweet onions and cook them until somewhat caramelized in a small saucepan with butter. And then I add in some high-quality curry powder and stir, stir, stir. It is a bit like making a roux, if you've ever done that. You want to change the raw powder into one where the aromatic oils can come alive again. Now, add a small amount, a half a cup will do, of orange or apple juice, and reduce it down over heat by about half. Allow that to cool, and then strain some of the resulting syrup into the mayo. Like I say, easy. I think most of us associate curry with India. It is interesting to note that the first domesticated chicken appeared in India around 2000 BC. It was bred from the wild red jungle fowl. In history, as in the kitchen, sometimes tragedy can strike. Food scholar John Mariani wrote of one such time. He says, in Hawaii, European travelers found a domesticated fowl called the moa, a descendant of a wild jungle fowl, probably brought in from Malaysia. In 1826, however, the ship Wellington docked in Hawaii from a port in Mexico, taking on fresh water and dumping its old water, which contained mosquito larvae, carrying a bird pox that immediately infected the Hawaiian chickens and devastated the birds of the islands. I wonder if the chicken haters in Key West have heard of this idea. Hopefully not. With our new focus on well-raised local birds here in Florida, you can be sure that we can enjoy chicken curry as much as the one I had back in Hawaii. And don't forget that other Indian thing, chutney. I'm Norman Van Aken, and that's my word on food.
Please tune in this coming Saturday morning at 8:34 on Weekend Edition to hear Tamales. And here's our South Florida Arts Beat Entertainment Calendar. And today we welcome back Jody Horn-Leschinski, Community Development Director of the Broward Cultural Division. Jody, it's been too long.
I know. I feel like I never get to speak to you anymore, but here I am.
So. Here you are, and you're going to fill us in on all the excitement in Broward County.
Yes, here we go in Broward County. This weekend we have lots of stuff. But first of all, I wanted to tell you that Broward Cultural Division and Business for the Arts of Broward is so pleased to announce that we have Florida Power and Light Company as this year's title sponsor for the 2013 Broward County Arts Teacher of the Year event, which is coming up in November. And this year, all three, public, private, and charter schools, are able to invite their art teachers to either be nominated or nominate themselves for this honor of excellence. And this year's application deadline is May 31st. So arts teachers out there, get online and fill out that application. We want to see lots and lots of entries this year. And this year we will have not just one winner, we will have four winners in four categories. So there'll be a winner in dance, music, theater, and visual arts. And the four winners will be announced the night of the event, which is November 6th at the Broward Center. So we look forward to that. Broward Cultural Division and Broward County Transit have recently partnered to bring residents the Comprehensive Family Arts and Transit Guide, one of the many free services offered by our division to residents. The guide is a listing of organizations that offer arts programming for families by location, name, phone number, website, and transit route to get there. The map provides the bus routes plotted and the major thoroughfares, as well as cultural venues that offer the family arts programming. And the guide is clear and compact for easy storage in your handbag, or for the men out there, in your desk drawer for easy access. If you need a guide, please call our office and we'd be happy to mail you one. And the number is 954-357-7457. Currently on display at the Fort Lauderdale Hollywood International Airport's Lee Waggoner Art Gallery is Tom DeVita, and his series is called The Locals, and it's on the departures level of Terminal 2 of the airport and will run through July 1st. And he was inspired by the wonderful and eclectic characters that he has met since he moved to South Florida. And he feels that the exhibition is an exploration into the personalities and the symbols that define these people. DeVita is from New York City, and he's an academically trained artist. And the Lee Waggoner Art Gallery is supported by the Broward Cultural Division's Public Art and Design Program and the Broward County Aviation Department, and it offers Broward artists an opportunity to exhibit their work in a prominent and high-traffic area. And artists are selected through the Public Art and Design Program. The City of Fort Lauderdale and Riverwalk have partnered with Cadence, which is a downtown-based landscape architect and urban design firm, to collaborate on a public art and music installation. It's called FTL Play Your City, and it was launched during last week's Fat Village Art Walk and featured the brigade of artistically designed pianos all in one venue for the public to view before they are dispersed throughout downtown Fort Lauderdale. The public will also have a hand in deciding the final location of these pianos. Play Your City will feature repurposed pianos by artists Brian Bozella, Luzelma Gonzalez, Richard Verges, and two Museum of Art Fort Lauderdale Art Academy students. The Play Your City Brigade of Pianos will be in various locations throughout downtown Fort Lauderdale for a three-month period. And you can follow them on Facebook and Instagram. It's FTL Play Your City. So things coming up this weekend, lots and lots of stuff. Books and Books at the Museum of Art Fort Lauderdale is presenting two author talks and book signings. On Saturday at 11 a.m., Chris Rashaka will incorporate drawing and painting demonstrations as he speaks about his new book, Everyone Can Learn to Ride a Bicycle. And author Bob Stark will talk about Bluebird, an emotional picture book that will captivate young readers as they follow the journey of a bluebird as he develops a friendship with a young boy and ultimately risks his life to save the boy from harm. Then at 6 p.m., join Augustine Burroughs, author of This Is How, Surviving What You Think You Can't, in a discussion that if you believe life has a grudge against you and if you have ever wondered, how am I supposed to survive this, this is how. The Fort Lauderdale International Film Festival presents the timeless classic Alice's Adventures in Wonderland Ballet at 1 p.m. on Sunday at Cinema Paradiso. Those familiar with the Lewis J. Carroll's literary menagerie of colorful characters will enjoy the clarity from which Christopher Wheeldon portrays them in dance. The whole company is drawn into the fun, dancing, a myriad of quirky characters, a twitchy white rabbit, a tap-dancing Mad Hatter, a sinuous caterpillar, and so much more. Broward Center for the Performing Arts hosts the Florida Grand Opera's production of La Traviata Friday through Sunday, and they did add an extra performance. She was one of the most desirable women in Paris, but was labeled by society as La Traviata, or a woman who has gone astray. When she at last meets a young man with whom she truly falls in love, his father demands a supreme sacrifice from her to save the family's reputation. Arrive early for the free opera preview by the witty and captivating Justin Moss as he tells the inside story of each opera 1 hour prior to the performance.
Justin's great.
Justin is great. Love Justin. Coral Springs Center for the Arts invites all to Joey and Maria's comedy Italian Wedding through Sunday. It's just like a real Italian wedding, except at this one, the bridal party, families, and some uninvited guests are all actors. You'll meet the Godfather, Mama Nona, and all the wacky members of Joey and Maria's two zany families. You never know which crazy relatives will stop by your table. The audience members are the guests. If you would like more detailed cultural event information, please visit artscalendar.com. It's Broward's complete guide to arts and culture. Never miss a thing. Get there.
That's the always wonderfully informative Jody Horn-Leschinsky, Community Development Director of the Broward Cultural Division. Jody, thanks for all of that great information.
Thank you, Ed. Have a wonderful weekend.
I know you're going to have a great one.
Yes, I will.
Take care. May is Miami Museums Month, and that's organized by the Greater Miami Convention and Visitors Bureau. Take in Greater Miami and the beaches, special exhibits, world-class permanent collections, memorials, and more with Buy One, Get One Free and Join One, See Them All offerings. The Buy One, Get One Free gives admission to two for the price of one to any participating museum. And when you purchase a membership at any one of the participating museums, you can visit any of the other participating museums for free during May and Miami Music Month. And participating museums, a big list: Art Center South Florida, Bass Museum of Art, Coral Gables Merrick House, Coral Gables Museum, the Haitian Heritage Museum, History Miami, the Jewish Museum of Florida, FIU, the Low Art Museum on the University of Miami campus, the Miami Art Museum, the Patricia and Philip Frost Art Museum at FIU, Vizcaya, the Wolfsonian on the beach, the World Erotic Art Museum, and many, many other museums are participating in this wonderful month-long effort. For more information, you can visit MiamiMuseumMonth.com. May is Miami Museums Month. Also, there's some great jazz. The Gold Coast Jazz Society presents tonight their First Friday Jazz Jams from 7:30 to 9:30 at ArtServe, 1350 East Sunrise Boulevard in Fort Lauderdale. Free admission with open seating. Audience members of all ages are invited to attend. For further information, call the Gold Coast Jazz Society at 954-524-0805 or go to their website at goldcoastjazz.org. We'll rebroadcast South Florida Arts Beat tonight and every Friday night at 7 o'clock on our WLRN Extra HD channel. You can tune in on your HD radio or go to our beautiful website at WLRN.org for more information. And that's today's edition of South Florida Arts Beat. We hope you enjoyed the show. Adrian Kennedy is our executive producer. I'm Ed Bell, producer and host. Our theme was composed by Mike Levine and performed by Mike and Sam Levine. Special thanks to our technical director today, Andy Wagner, and our contributors, Charles Greenfield, Norman Van Aken, and Jody Horn-Leschinsky. We'd like to hear from you, so call us with your comments at 305-995-2258. You can fax us your event information to 305 305- 515-995-2221 or email it to us at info@wlrn.org. We'd like to hear from you. Monday at this time, Topical Currents with hosts Joseph Cooper and Bonnie Berman, Monday at 1 o'clock. Have yourself a great weekend, and as always, please keep your dial set here to 91.3 WLRN, South Florida's NPR news station, and 91.5 WKWM, NPR for the Florida Keys. Until next time, this is Ed Bell saying bye-bye. Enjoy.